Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Alioto.
And Daisy, who are we speaking with today?
Today we're speaking with Jesse Hirsch. He's the editor of Off Range. He spent years working as a journalist focused on food and agriculture, topic that comes up frequently on this podcast.
Love those things.
And he was most recently the managing editor at The Counter. His work has appeared in The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Guardian, San Francisco Chronicle, Bon Appetit, Eater, and other outlets.
Nice. Yeah, I'm excited to talk to Jesse. Before he gets here, though, I want to tell you about an insane experience I had at the cinema on Friday. I went to the Regal Essex.
Okay.
In Manhattan's Lower East Side to see Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. Really fun movie. I had a great time. It was an early showing. It was like 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. Went right at the end of the day. So, you know, any movie kind of near the end of its runtime at the Regal Essex, the theater's not that full. I'm sat in the back row and like there's only two other people in the back row besides me and Emma. And there's one seat between me and them. It's like the big Regal seats. Mm-hmm. And
why did you sit so close to them? Or did they sit so close to you?
I when I bought the seats and I selected them, they weren't there. But very quickly, like around 10 minutes in, I noticed that the woman who is the one closer to me is just scrolling her phone. And you know, I'm like, whatever, like maybe I'll say something. I didn't say anything. Anyway, she's scrolling
Greta Rainbow. The entire time. Greta Rainbow would have said something.
Greta, well, you know, I wish I was as strong as Greta. but pretty soon enough, pulls out a burrito. That's fine. I'm you know, bringing food into the theater to eat it. I'm cool with that. That's cool.
Yeah.
Halfway through the movie, she pulls out her laptop.
No.
Laptop in the middle of the movie. And I mean, this time I stare over and I just kind of stare at her until she puts it away. She has her laptop out for a full minute. She doesn't really do anything with it. She just kind of logs in. And I don't know if she's checking Wi-Fi or checking some document, puts it away. And then she keeps scrolling her phone for the rest of the movie. But I have never seen somebody take out a laptop.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was awful.
What time was the movie?
4:50.
What a weirdo. Yeah. I was going to say maybe she needed to like look like she was on Teams, but you can do that on your phone.
No. Yeah. I was scrolling her phone the entire time. Anyways, it was just awful.
Yeah.
But the movie was good. I enjoyed the movie. It was funny. It's like, you know, it's one of those movies that obviously the creators are used to working with a low budget and they got a little bit more budget for this, but it wasn't so much budget that they then didn't know what to do with it and ruined it. They like pulled it off.
That's good. That makes me happy.
I'm glad. I'm glad that makes you happy. The other thing in my life this weekend, I've fallen victim to these. Have you seen these Instagram ads? These ads on Instagram that are like modular ads for eBay or Depop or like niche secondhand sites that fill in. It's like, it'll be like,
are you a victim or are you a willing participant?
Where's the line? Can you tell me where the line is?
I think we all have to decide for ourselves.
So I spent $200 on Depop this weekend.
Wow.
Yeah.
Brave.
Brave.
What did you buy?
I bought,
brave to admit it on this podcast.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, I reveal a lot about myself. I embarrass myself on this podcast every week. I know that's not like your thing, but I bought a J. Crew sweater, 100%.
Just a few embarrassing things, perhaps.
That's probably true. I bought a nice pair of Levi 501s. Those are like $40. And I bought a 90s Armani shirt, sort of a fine rib. That was like $90 or $100.
And I'm sure that it was listed as 90s Armani shirt.
Yeah. That look, the ads know me. Anyways, Jesse's here. Let's get to know him. You left New York.
You left New York. Where are you?
Massachusetts.
Oh, that's where I'm from. Massachusetts.
Okay.
Are you from there?
I am.
I'm from Wrentham.
I don't know what that is.
Wrentham Runway?
It's
Does it have a W in it?
Yeah, it's 5 minutes from Gillette Stadium.
Okay.
So Foxborough, Attleboro. Where are you in the Berkshires?
Just shy of the Berkshires. Okay. Pioneer Valley, Smith College.
Yeah.
Nice. Area.
Nice. Gillette Stadium.
I love that area.
I read recently that FIFA owes the Foxborough City Council, Town Council, something like this, like $8 million, something like that, maybe even more, because they're going to have World Cup games at Gillette Stadium.
Oh, yeah.
But FIFA isn't coughing up, which I can relate to that, having some World Cup tickets that are currently, I've resold through the FIFA reselling platform, and it's been 60 days since I resold them. They still haven't paid me. That's a private grievance that I'm airing out here. But so Offrange recently published a story about grass in World Cup stadiums. So why?
Oh, I was wondering how you were going to handle that transition. Very elegant.
Yeah, it was quite elegant. And also that you have something in common with the Foxborough City Council is kind of interesting too.
Should I not? What's up with the Foxborough City Council?
No, nothing. I just think that you guys should be allies in your debt recovery.
Against the evil entity that is FIFA.
You should write a letter of support, Francis.
I should sue FIFA is what I should do.
We should all sue FIFA.
Yeah.
That piece of price was a sham.
The story that we did was about how basically for World Cup, a lot of the stadiums that they're using do not use natural grass. They use like AstroTurf, and it's kind of a really like the stadiums in Europe will have it all the time. They figure, you know, they just play soccer all the time, but this is going to be like a one and done. So they spent $5 million on sod research, basically figuring out how to just like zoom in, roll down some nice
FIFA grass. FIFA spent this money.
FIFA did. Yes. They put $5 million into research, in collaboration with some universities and farmers. And it's going to be a big boon for the sod farming industry, which is like not something that people think about very much, but it is like a whole cohort. They're trying to get their own like lobbying group right now, actually, the sod farmers of America.
Is there like a specific state where most of the sod farmers are located or something like that?
Rhode Island, actually. Oddly enough, if you drive through Rhode Island, you will see a lot of it looks like huge lawns, but they're being like watered by like industrial irrigation machines.
I would have thought
sod and there. Cranberry bogs. Mm-hmm. Everyone who grew up in New England has the canonical experience of going on the cranberry bog field trip.
That's true. And very few, I think, have the sod field trip in their memory.
My parents brought us to. Like, you wake up on a Saturday and they're like, get up, we're going to cranberry bog. And then you never see a cranberry bog again in your whole life. But it sticks with you. Taking a step back, I realized we never really said what Offrange is. So it's a digital publication covering American agriculture, food production, and natural resources. Yes. Published 3 original stories each week, a monthly podcast, a weekly newsletter. It's a lot. That's you're putting up dirt numbers. And so we can get into like Ambrook versus Offrange, because I know there was a little bit of a rebrand recently, but started off and is still nested within a company that builds software tools for family run American farms. Mm-hmm. So how does that work? And did you guys fully rebrand?
Yes, fully rebrand. From Ambrook Research to Offrange. So when I first started out, I had just left another publication, The Counter, which is a nonprofit doing food and agriculture coverage. And somebody said, do you want to have a conversation with the CEO of this company, Ambrook, that I had never heard of? And I was a little iffy on it because I thought it would be a marketing job. Like, I thought this was going to be like editing press releases or, you know, dealing with the website. But it was a very kind of exciting and novel idea. It was like, here's this thing that we want to start. We don't know exactly how it's going to look. They had done, like it existed, they had 10 different articles up, and most of them were research projects that someone had done in collaboration with like university professors. It was more like an academic study than it was an article. But yeah, Mackenzie, the CEO, was just like, we loved The Counter. I think that providing news and information for people who actually are working in farming and ranching would be like a great service, you know, to the people that we would like as customers ultimately. They did that, and they also did this funding library, which was like a resource for farmers to go on and figure out all the grants and loans that they could apply for anywhere. And these were just kind of thought of as little gifts, little bonbons for the industry. And she was like, so I don't know exactly how it would look, but like in collaboration with you, like, could we try this out? And so we just did it for 3 months. I was a little nervous about the idea of editorial independence because I had never worked at a place that was like funded by one specific company. But after 3 months, I was like, okay, no, this is not just like marketing light. This is like a real actual agricultural publication. So I think I got hired in July maybe. And then by December, we were actually putting out the 3 stories a week and the newsletter.
How long had Ambrook, the company, been around by the time you joined?
Well, I get like mixed answers to that because, you know, with the clock started kind of when the 3 founders sat around in a living room, you know, and were just like whiteboarding it. But They said it was about 2 years when I was there. They had gone around and actually done kind of a listening tour to figure out from farmers around the country what the pain points were in their bookkeeping and their finances, like how they could be useful rather than just like busting in and disrupting without knowing what they were dealing with.
Yeah. A question too, on the difference between like what you're doing in marketing as somebody who runs a publication owned by a company that is to some extent marketing myself. I was clicking around on the Embrook website and I saw that you guys are hiring your first content marketing hire, which is like,
that's right.
Reading that, it's like, okay, so you know,
Francis, are you throwing your
I'm throwing my hand in the ring. No, I'm happily employed. No, but I thought this was really interesting because like this, the like what that tells me is that like what you do was, even though it's like not marketing, as you said, it's also not marketing. And for the first few years of you doing it, it's like the bet has been that this is our content marketing function. And then only now, 3 years later, do we need like a formal content marketing function. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm just curious about like the degree to which Offrange is and is not content marketing for Embrook.
Sure. I mean, I think the key thing is just like intent and how explicit it is. You know, like, yes, we put out this newsletter every week, but, you know, I'm not telling you about Embrook products that you can buy or like, you know, what a smooth and seamless system it is. But I will talk about, you know, like if, this week we went on a team retreat, right? And interestingly, even though there is full editorial independence, like I worked in the New York office, like I consider these people my colleagues, the engineers, yeah, the salespeople. So, I mean, in that sense, like, just general Embrook positivity that I exude, like that would function as some kind of marketing. But I think it's pretty key that, like, you know,
Jesse, I don't want to hold you to it, but you did promise me a hat at one point.
I did. I was just thinking about that actually at the team.
I was waiting to confront you on mic.
I almost wore that hat, but then I was like, it's too on the nose. Yeah. Do you want the white one or the dark one? I can't remember.
Oh,
I want the dark one, if that's okay.
Yeah,
this isn't about you.
I'm making it about me.
Reggie has the dark one. Reggie, yeah. James has also been on this podcast. They're both so nice.
All right, you can. So if I can split it, I have one dark and one cream colored. So
okay, send me the cream and Francis the
amazing
dark.
Okay, well, so on this topic of like editorial and pen separation, like with what I do, so I do Creator Spotlight for Beehive newsletter and more software company. And what I do, like sometimes I'll write about people who use Beehive, but I see it more as like I'm propagating this worldview that's aligned with Beehive's customers, right? Which is like, this is a certain type of creator. This is a certain type of digital media entrepreneur. I'm promoting that way of working, right? With Embrook, so looking at the editorial guidelines on your website, there was one line I pulled. We will avoid coverage of a particular company, organization, or individual if there is a working relationship with Embrook, the company that funds Offrange. We strive at all times to maintain editorial independence, but sometimes the reality of doing business will inevitably influence coverage decisions. So my question is like, you know, what I'm doing with Curtis Spotlight is I see it as like worldview propagation. Is like the mission of Offrange to, like, is there a defined worldview that you guys work around?
I would say no. I mean, there's no such thing as like journalistic neutrality, right? But I think that there is kind of like, we have our readership is 60% farmers and ranchers, right? And that's like from all sides of the types of farm, like the ideological spectrum. And for, you know, we have like small CSA farmers in Vermont, and then we also have like row crop farmers in Iowa and cattle ranchers in Texas. And we hear from them. That's how I know, because they're vocal, you know, and we hear complaints sometimes about, you know, like that, you know, like that coverage is too crunchy. You're not really taking in the economic realities of what I have to deal with day to day, or vice versa, you know, like, wow, how could you promote something that's like destroying the planet? So essentially, I mean, I'm trying to walk a pretty fine line down the middle and present, you know, just the facts on the ground of what is happening in agriculture and like scientific studies on, you know, pesticide runoff, or you know, like we'll do labor stories and just take them where they go. You know, and sometimes that's going to inevitably end up seeming like coded one way or the other.
Well, the scientific studies, from what I understand, like that's really the core of this, is like you're looking for data in and around like the agriculture farming, and that is the foundation of your stories. What's the hard data we can find that has something to say, and then we will build stories around that.
This is true. But I do think that there's also a very human part of it too, right? Like we, we insist that there's going to be some farmer or rancher voice in every story. And if it's like, let's say it's about lobster fishing, then it's going to be a lobsterman. Or if it's about livestock veterinarians, we're going to have a livestock veterinarian who speaks, right? Like, I think a lot of like mainstream coverage of agriculture can sometimes not actually include the voices of, you know, the people being covered. It'll be like advocates, politicians, academics without. So yeah, as it's evolved, I feel like those voices have become more prominently pieces of the articles. And we even do like first person essays now, which I think has been really nice. Like just hearing actual stories from farmers. Yeah.
We mentioned the rebrand earlier, but I did want to follow up on that. So you wrote a piece about the rebrand and how when you joined, you were like, hey, are we married to the name? And they said, yes, we want to promote Ambrook. Right. So it has to be called Ambrook Research. And then it was last summer, I think in June, that you launched the rebrand. Yep. Why were you able to do it then? I imagine it's connected to like, you know, now they're hiring a content marketer. So they're now making a more dedicated marketing effort. I don't know why I'm answering the question for you. Why were you finally able to rebrand?
I think there's a few reasons. Like one thing that's interesting is like, obviously when we were first doing this thing, it was a calling card too, right? Like it was a way to like get the word Ambrook. Like that's what I was told, right? Like we have to keep Ambrook in there because no one knows who Ambrook is yet. You know, like we're still making a name for ourselves. And this is just like another way that the name is on people's lips. But then as I understand it, like some of the agriculture conventions that like the salespeople would go to, people would come up and be like, oh, I love Ambrook. And then they try to sell them accounting software and they're like, no, I mean the stories. Like
it was too successful in owning the name.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a little bit of that. And then I also think that there is kind of a push like to ultimately make like an incubator that makes off-range or, you know, Ambrook Research, this media brand become something that can stand on its own 2 feet someday. And like there are challenges with working with it with one company alone that, you know, like I feel like maybe more kind of investigative features, for instance, you know, like looking at difficult issues in agriculture could be accomplished if we were able to achieve full independence. So like changing the name was a way of kind of giving a little more sunlight between the two.
How many people work on it full time on Off-Range?
It's me. I mean, we have almost a full time designer. And like, that's a big part of it too, is I think the look is really distinct. A lot of care put into the way that it kind of feels, the newsletter and the stories.
How did you get into the food and architecture beat originally?
I did one of those like funny things where you send a publisher of a magazine a typo that you found on their website. And then you're like, hey, I found this typo, but also I'm available for any of your editing needs. It was Edible Queens magazine. I was living in Astoria, Queens, and this is a small food magazine. And I read this like New York Post story about the publisher, and it was all about how overworked she was. And I was like, And it was just a beautiful publication. Like Anthony Bourdain was on the front cover of the first issue. And I just like, it made me proud to live in Queens. And I was like, oh, nice. Okay. Getting some recognition. You know, this was over a decade ago. So I wrote to her and the gambit worked. She was like, yes, I'm actually like, have no help at all. I'll take you on as a part-time editor. And then I just started freelancing about food. First full-time food writing job was as a restaurant critic in Oakland at the Alt Weekly, which is really strange and kind
of. Can you tell us about that? What was the scene? This was in the early 2010s. What was the scene you were covering back then?
It was Oakland getting fancy. That was my assignment. They took it seriously enough, even though this was an Alt Weekly, that I had to scrub my picture off the web. I had to get a fake credit card. I had to get a fake like Open Table account. Like they were like, you're going to do the real food critic thing.
Wow.
I lived in, it was a weird, I did a reverse commute. I was living in San Francisco, commuting to Oakland every day. I just kind of got dropped in. I felt like I parachuted in there because, you know, I knew San Francisco, but I didn't know Oakland that well. So it was kind of documenting the fancification of Oakland. That's what it felt like.
Do you still absorb a lot of food and restaurant criticism, or have you divested from the scene? I know that it's changed also a lot.
I think that it's like in me personally, you know, I just think that I personally like to go to restaurants, and now that I'm in Western Mass, you know, like this is like a burgeoning scene of like really good places to eat. So I enjoy it. And I nerd out a little more than maybe my friends want me to, you know, like I can talk for a while. But professionally, no, I don't put much into that. It really is just like places that I could potentially go to and have a good meal.
What's the difference? The
Go ahead, Francis.
No, Daisy, you have a better.
I was going to ask. We love to ask people what the best meal they had so far this year was.
Oh goodness. I think that I would say it was like on New Year's Eve, a place in Northampton called Dirty Truth, that was like, we went there because it seemed like it was like fun vibes and good cocktails, but then the food was just like phenomenal. And because I don't think I had high expectations, it went through the roof. I had a pork pasta dish that, like, this is why it wasn't that great of a restaurant critic, is because like the details of an actual dish
can't even tell me the shape of the pasta.
Yeah, it was like long. You
know, long works.
I had the best. This is like years ago. I still think about this. It was a restaurant for Scythia in Manhattan. I had these beef short rib agnolotti, which are like those little like dumpling like little pockets, and it was, the sauce was this like cooked down beef jus, so unctuous.
You're doing good.
Reminded me of that. Yeah. See, I'm auditioning.
Unctuous.
Francis would be a good restaurant critic.
For Edible Queens. I would. In another life, I am one, but that's not this life.
Can I say that candidly, like, I was not a great restaurant critic. Like, I think I was good at describing like the feel of like what it would be like to be there, the atmosphere, like who this is for. But in terms of like actually describing the food on your plate, I would always call the chef afterwards to be like, so that, you know, like I loved that sesame noodles dish, and they'd be like, there was no sesame in that. That was lemongrass or whatever, you know, like that happened to me a lot. And I was like, your palate is not, you're not a super taster. So anyway,
so atmosphere is all some people care about. So
yeah,
maybe we just be an atmosphere critic. That'll be a new job.
Well, that's just called an architecture critic, I think.
Fair enough.
What's the difference for you, in as much as there is one, in covering food restaurants versus farming and agriculture?
It feels like a pretty distinct difference. Although I was just talking to, I'm going to talk about a freelance pitch that I just took yesterday, because it was kind of a foodie pitch. It was about the taste of bitter, and like a long held, like that in the food industry, bitter is kind of like frowned upon, but then in other cultures, bitter is like one of the many flavors that people enjoy. Mm-hmm. And it was about like marketing efforts to sell certain bitter produce here in the United States, and like, you know, whether or not that will take off and how challenging that is. And I was like, it's kind of about the consumer, and it's kind of about the palate. That's almost not an off-range story, but also like, it's kind of funky and weird. And like, we would be able to get into like the people who are growing these vegetables. So like, but I think that that's probably the outer limit of what we would do. I don't know. A lot of food writing, I'm going to like alienate myself from people that I know, but like, it just feels a bit precious, you know, like it feels like it's not taking into the context of like everything that got it to the plate. And I think just after doing this for a while, that ends up feeling a bit frivolous to me, you know, like I want to know about the labor that went into it, you know, like the bottom line of the people who are growing the food, things like that.
I think that's tell us about some like the farming, agriculture, people who are growing the food type of work you were doing before Off-Range and Ambrook.
So are you too familiar with Modern Farmer, how it initially hit the scene, the magazine?
I'm not.
No. I'll send you a New York Times like article that they wrote making fun of it. Basically, when it came out, it was like a glossy lifestyle magazine. It was like 2014, I think.
Kinfolk vibes.
Very, very kinfolk vibes. The person who started it came from Monocle. And it was very much like, because this was a time when you had that story of like the Wall Street broker who's like, I'm just going to open a cupcake truck or you know, even better, I'm going to go and buy, like,
oh my God, that was a time.
Buy like 10 sheep or a winery or something and just live off the land.
Late stage stomp clap hay.
Yes, exactly.
That's hay, H-A-Y.
That was good. I'm picturing like a lot of like hands with like the soil. Through it, you know,
stock photos.
Yeah. Stock photos. Like,
if you, Jesse, if you ever want to write a piece for Dirt about like the conventions of the farming stock photo, I'd be very down to publish it.
We actually at Modern Farmer, we published like just a daily piece where we said it was like 24 photos of people holding soil, and we just tried to like do an array, and then like Jake, like our digital editor, just made little snarky captions for each one.
That's really funny.
But yeah, so Modern Farmer was like this very weird hybrid, because it kind of was like, we did a fashion shoot with actual like good-looking mm-hmm. farmers wearing like a high-end work gear. But then it also was also like hard-hitting journalism too. Like the first story that I did for them was I went to Mississippi and investigated how wild pigs were kind of like running wild, were like ruining the land. And
years before 30 to 50 Wild Hog.
Years before 30 to 50 Wild Hogs came out, and I'm like, that's my beat.
Never has somebody been.
I've been working on this for a decade, and they just tweeted it out.
They just tweeted it out. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, we did a lot of serious agriculture journalism, and I just had never gone there before. And I was just like, ooh, I like this. You know, like I don't have a farm background. This isn't like something that was like in my blood, but it was just really interesting. And I loved how agriculture journalism kind of intersects with like technology and culture and business. You know, like you can make a lot of different types of stories with farming mm-hmm. at the core. And it seems like that was like a really good time for it too, because that was a time when a lot of people were just like getting interested in like what's on their plate, and the farm to table was kind of like, you know, going through the roof. So there was a good built-in readership of like farmers market shoppers is what we kind of thought of as our target demo.
I was talking to my mother on the phone this weekend. So I grew up on a small farm in Northern California, 8 acres, organic produce, flowers, nursery starts. And speaking of farmers market shoppers in that era, so let's say, you know, 2010 to 2014, I would work the farmer's market in the summers and on Saturdays. And I remember when you say farmer's market shoppers, I think of the people who I'd be standing near the front of the booth, and we had our Romanesco displayed there, right? And it's a beautiful vegetable, beautiful brassica, beautiful. That Romanesco. And people would say, what is this? And they'd take photos, and I'd tell them, oh, so it's, you know, kind of like broccoli, kind of like cauliflower. It's really good. And they'd say, huh. And then they would move on and not buy any. And I hated those people. Hated them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just want
to. Oh, that's it. That you're still mad. Okay.
I'm just bitter. I'm bitter. Like, just
bitter like the flavor.
Bitter like the flavor. Yes, yeah. Exactly. You'll have your day.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, we also at Modern Farmer did a Romanesco story because our intern, who is a little dreamy, she loved how it's a fractal.
It's
right?
Fractals, yeah.
It's a fractal, and like that's the only vegetable that it was. So it's like she just like wrote a personal essay that was like an ode to like the beauty of looking at a Romanesco.
And I bet she also came to my booth and didn't buy any goddamn Romanesco.
No, she didn't want it. She was all set.
Okay.
She what were you gonna say? Sorry, Daisy.
I'm sorry that your intern's catching strays here.
I know, I did not mean to do that.
I was gonna say, What else do you know about your subscribers? Like, how do you know 60% of them are in the industry? Do you do surveys?
No, I mean, we did do a survey at the beginning, but the survey was kind of more, what do you want? Mm-hmm. Like, what kind of stories do you want to read right now? You know, and that was back when we had like a readership of maybe 5,000. It really is an estimate. Like we do some data enhancement with our subscribers, you know, like we've put it through that, and that's kind of what it is. But I think that we could like drill down a lot deeper if we wanted to, just at this point we haven't. So yeah, 60% is a rough estimate based on just like taking the email addresses and names and kind of like figuring out what we can know about them.
In that, that rebrand write-up, you said that there was around 140,000 total subscribers.
Yeah. Now it's like 150. Three, maybe.
Where did they come from?
A lot of it is just organic growth. But then we also like have had media partnerships with like Investigate Midwest and Fast Company. And then like, do you know Knowable magazine?
Mm-hmm.
No. It's very science driven, like kind of all topics, nature and environment. They just today put a banner ad in there for us. Like we do link exchanges with other like-minded places. Study Hall, we've used a lot to kind of raise awareness.
Yeah, Daisy was on the Study Hall podcast this week.
It was. We should chat. Maybe there's something you could do with dirt. It feels natural.
It does.
It feels natural.
It does.
You said that you get a lot of feedback, that this is a very vocal audience. Can you tell us more about that? The kind of thing they say, what are they saying to you?
Like, okay, we did a story on tractor theft, right? Like it was pretty straightforward. And, you know, sometimes we get these story ideas just from farmer message boards. Like I like to see what people are chatting about. And that was one.
Is there a Hacker News for farmers?
The closest thing, it's called New Ag Talk. Mm-hmm. Everyone just calls it Ag Talk, but the official thing, if you look at the website, is New Ag Talk, one word. And it's like, it feels like it's a very a place for conventional farmers, like people who have had farms in their generation, in their family for like 5 to 10 generations. And I don't know if you can actually see the post without becoming a member. Like, it's a little bit insular. It's kind of an exclusive.
Does Farmers Only still exist?
Yes, it does.
You I don't said know yes pretty quickly.
I thought that was a joke. I didn't know that was a real thing.
Well, you thank God you thought it was a joke. I can't even imagine the havoc you would have wrecked on there.
Yeah. Do you know what Farmers Only is?
To my knowledge, it's a dating site. Yeah, for farmers.
Yeah. For farmers. Yeah. Yeah.
You thought it was a joke?
I thought that was a joke to you? Yeah. Yeah, it's a joke to me.
The love lives of farmers? Seriously, man. I mean, anecdotally, I have heard that site has been great for people relocating. You know, that like it's really good. Like, let's say you live in a town of 300 people and you probably like blazed through the dating pool. Like, it's a good way to see, oh, you know, 5 towns over, there's someone who actually shares my interests who I never met otherwise, you know.
That makes sense. Like,
yeah.
Does it extend to like fishing people, fishermen?
I don't know.
I would say surely that might be as fishers only. Somebody from a farming family. Definitely not. Different type of guy.
Well, he said off range covers lobstermen. So
true.
We do. But I think that if we were ever to like, you know, spin off a dating situation ourselves, like we would keep the farmers and the fishermen distinct.
What would you call the fishing one? Fishing people? Because they already have like too many fish in the sea.
Surf and turf.
Oh my God. That sounds really dirty.
Yeah, that's
surf and turf could be like the sniffies, and you don't.
The tractor theft. Sorry. So brilliant. I just like basically it turns out there was like a rash of tractor theft in like northern Kentucky. That's what this person was bringing up. And I realized that it was just not something that I've ever seen addressed. A story like story ideas or just something like that. Like, let's look into this. And I've got some contributing writers who are like great for that kind of thing. Like, they'll have no subject matter expertise on that and they'll just start digging. And so one of our writers like started looking into it, and it turns out that it is actually for like the small tractor. A lot of farmers just leave their keys in the tractor. That's the that's the number one reason why it's like an easy take. But that said, it's very difficult to get away. Like, you can't just like you can't just ride down the road on someone else's tractor. So you do have to have the infrastructure to come pick it up in like a big semi or something like that. So just, you know, she talked to like law enforcement and, you know, some farmers who had actually suffered through the. But my gosh, like the number of people who just like wrote in and wanted to tell a story about like how 17 years ago, like their neighbor, you know, like had put a four wheeler in their barn and, you know, they thought everything was safe. It was just like, it was anecdote after anecdote after anecdote. Like everyone had a personal story. So that's often what it is. It's kind of like, I recognize that, or I don't recognize that, that other people would write in and be like, I've never seen theft. So I don't know if that's real.
First, real quick, are you more of a Kubota guy or a John Deere guy?
Wait, there's a third one too.
I don't know what the third one is. That's the kind of
it's,
guy.
It's the blue, the green, the red. But now I'm
just like Pokemon. Well, which one are you?
I would say John Deere.
Okay. Like, classic.
I did a modern farmer story in Iowa a long time ago, and the lady at the Chamber of Commerce gave me a little green John Deere tractor as a gift. That's the only
one. Have you gotten to the bottom of why like aliens love cows? I feel like every time I read about an alien abduction, it's like. And they messed with the cow.
No, but that's a really good question, though.
It's a regal beast. Who wouldn't love them?
Maybe you could do an audience survey about their experiences with tractor theft.
Come on, dude. I find
alien abductions. Aliens are taking the tractors.
I am offended.
The truth is out there. Open your eyes.
The truth is in the field and in the sky. Tell us about your writers. Like, do you have a stable of, you know, very consistent writers where once, you know, every month you're publishing something from this person, what percentage? Yeah. Just tell us about your writers.
Okay. So I took, like, when I first started out, I just ported over my favorite writers from the counter, right? Like, that was the easiest way to do this. I was just like, we have this thing. It's like wide open field. We can do whatever we want. You know, what stories, ideas you have. And then I put out calls for pitches for a while, which netted some really good people. And yeah, so I have writers who will write like one piece and then disappear forever. And then I have people who are maybe like on a monthly cadence. And then I have like some writers will write almost every week too. The interesting thing I think is that most of them are not like ag background writer even or food even necessarily. Like I have like one of my favorite go-to reporters is mostly like criminal justice outside of writing for offering.
What are some of the stories they've written for you?
She wrote the chapter step sort of. That was a good she's in grad school right now. So she's been out of the loop for a little bit. Oh, she did a Ponzi scheme. There was a cattle Ponzi scheme that involved actual like people.
Did she cut you in?
She didn't cut me in, but she talked to the North Dakota Commissioner of Agriculture, who was he called her in the middle of the night, just like upset about this like terrible company that was like bilking millions of dollars literally from cattle ranchers. That's a good story. You should check it out if you can find it.
What about some of the other writers who have a unexpected background that they bring to the work?
A lot of tech writers, and that's not that surprising because like the ecosystem, like I feel like I'm kind of like in the hybrid tech journalism world role, right? Like somebody who wrote this week was actually just like best friends with one of the engineers on my team. And like, I'm open to it, right? I feel like if you can craft a solid pitch or you've got an interesting story to tell, let's just talk about like what the needs are and give it a run. But yeah, like I don't think she had ever written on agriculture before this week.
I have more of a meta question, which is, you know, coming from Modern Farmer, The Counter, sort of seeing this, the arc of the farm to table era, the way that it manifested in cities like in Brooklyn and Oakland, and the way that people talked about it. But like, how has the media landscape changed along with the evolution of this beat? Like, obviously, restaurant criticism today, it's very driven by social media. The critics aren't anonymous. It's sort of sometimes it's even seen as an asset for the critic to be somebody who has built a following of their own. We've talked a lot about Eater, like kind of getting rid of a lot of their traditional criticism, but then hiring people who are like prolific Yelpers to write. And I'm interested like how those shifts, like your perspective on those shifts and what's next for this beat. Is it people having individual newsletters? Is it more projects within larger organizations like Offrange?
Maybe I'm naive, but I still have hope that there'll be a return to something a little more thriving in both this area of journalism and everywhere. I think part of the reason that I've been able to work with people who don't necessarily consider food and agriculture their beat is because there are just fewer and fewer places to write in general. And it's like, okay, well, you know, you pay decently and you'll give it a good edit and we'll have some nice art with the story. Like let's get into it. But yeah, I mean, I think we've contracted. Like there are very few publications I even consider like competition at this point, you know, and nobody's doing exactly what we're doing. You know, like I think that like some of the agriculture publications are more lean towards the advocacy side. Like there's more of like a point of view, right? Like they're sustainability focused. I don't know. You know, like I feel like I'm on a bit of an island. Like this is a good, thriving, sustaining place that I am. And we're doing well. But it feels rather bleak when you look elsewhere. Like Eater kind of hit me hard. Like I feel like Eater kind of came up when I was first starting to do food writing. And now it's
you've
just
got violence like, there. Yeah.
I do. And we do writers that I admire that get laid off. I will reach out to them. Like Jaya Saxena wrote for us a couple things for us when she just left Eater. Yeah, that's the thing too. Like I tried to think of this as like a place that people could have like at least a temporary home, you know, while they're looking around for another journalism job.
Would you ever do a print edition?
We did.
You did? Shows what I know. Jeez.
No, we did. There is when we were Amber Research, it looks like a little academic journal. Daisy, did you get one when you
I don't think so. How does one, if somebody's a listener is interested, if I'm interested, how does one get their hand on?
They're pretty exclusive. I think we only have like maybe 40 left, 40 or 50 left, but I could send you two one. I think that's this conversation.
$100 each, guys. Name your price.
I want to send my parents one. I'm thinking of like, you know, my parents being farmers, they're early 70s. My father was for a long time pretty technologically not literate, let's say. He got his first smartphone maybe a year ago, maybe 2 years ago. Big magazine guy, Dwell, that was his favorite for many years.
Dwell,
like Scranta.
Nice. Great magazine.
Got him onto Apartmento recently. He likes that. Replaced Dwell for him. Anyways, all of which is to say, like, he is somebody who I know would love reading this stuff, but he, until the last year or two, is somebody who would have never ever come across it because it's just not, you know, he listens to the radio and reads magazines and the newspaper. That's how he plays the game. But I imagine there's like a younger generation of farmers too who are more online. I don't really know where I'm going with this. I guess the point is, it seems to me that this is something that would be really well served by a more routine print cadence, quarterly, once a year, at least something like that. Like this audience specifically would be really well served by that.
I think that's 1,000,000% true. I think it's like a resource issue, like, or bandwidth more, you know, like it was a labor of love, me and the creative director at Ambrook, you know, like locked ourselves in a room in suburban Boston for a week and just like, you let our wildest ideas just run free. And it's like a really nice, it's a little more, dare I say, artistic than the website, you know, like it's less straight news reporting and more kind of like somebody meeting their idol, Wendell Berry, kind of the influential farmer thinker, just, you know, like personal essays. I wrote a story about how I got something really wrong once in a freelance piece about cows for the Wall Street Journal.
Aliens don't love them?
No, it's that I called a cow.
Oh, that's a great story. Tell us more.
That's it. It was
a story. That's what you wrote. I called a bull a cow. That's what you wrote.
Bullgate.
No, bullshit, obviously.
Oh yeah. What did you call it?
It was okay. So this was a story. It was a story on the only cow in Manhattan. I called it the headline was the loneliest cow in Manhattan. At the Central Park Zoo, there was one cow that was used to kind of teach kids about food systems. Mm. Right. And basically like, one of the premises of the story was that it was specifically like a dairy cow from upstate New York. And so kids were supposed to go by and they're like, this is where your milk comes from. And the kids are like, yay, oh, interesting. But it was a guy. I called it a cow throughout. And all these farmers were like, that's not a cow, that's a bull. Like, you don't know the difference.
So pedantic.
And B, kind of like the gotcha at the very end of the behind the scenes piece I wrote for the off-range story was that bulls can't make milk. So the entire premise of everything is that like this is supposed to teach them that like milk comes from them, but that's like, it doesn't even make sense as a story. Or
also the Wall Street Bull. There's two bulls.
This is the publication, the Wall Street Journal, and it just never.
Now you have to write another one. Another retraction. Jesse, thank you so much for coming on Tasteland.
This is a blast.
We'll see you next week.